This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today we're talking about how people define success and how to work towards making it happen. Later in the show, we'll talk about how important it is to figure out what success means and the relationship between success and happiness. Up first, we'll learn about a recent national survey that aimed to find out how Black women define happiness and success. With us now is Gabriel Wyatt, founder of the Highland Project, a nonprofit working to bring opportunities to Black women. Thank you so much for joining us, Gabriel.
Thank you for having me, Miriam.
And I'm sorry, I'm thinking I should be pronouncing it Gabrielle.
That's right. You got it. No problem.
So Gabrielle, the Highland Project worked on a national survey of Black women to find out how they defined happiness and success. How did this report come about?
Sure. This report came about because of our mission. We're focused on building and sustaining a pipeline of Black women leaders of communities, institutions, and systems across the nation who are all in pursuit of multi-generational wealth and change. And we're focused on that because we unapologetically believe in the intellectual, political, and economic power of Black women. And yet at the same time, we know that we are too often pushed to the sidelines, particularly in policy conversations that ultimately results in the creation of multi-generational wealth and change. And so we started this study because we wanted to ask Black women directly, we wanted to ask and to listen. Listening is the most important piece I want you to hear. What do Black women need to achieve multi-generational wealth and change? And for us, at the core of that was really understanding what Black women mean when they say they want multi-generational wealth, what policy solutions do they need to see, and most importantly, what are the top barriers that need to be removed to achieve that wealth. And so this summer, we partnered with Cornell Belcher at Brilliant Corners Research and Strategies to do just that. We listened. We surveyed over 700 Black women across the country, at least 18 years of age and registered to vote. And we began to ask them a series of questions about what did success mean and what would it take to get there.
And so what did you hear? I mean, you mentioned that you were wanting to listen and really hear what these women were saying. What did you hear overall?
Sure. You know, I'd say that first and foremost, Black women are not a monolith. I'm a Black woman. I know that. I know that we come in all shapes, sizes, and views. And our research proved just that. And so a couple of things stick out to me, Miriam, as I think about the research. I'd say, you know, first and foremost, Black women plan to continue to demonstrate their political power. An overwhelming majority of over 90% say that they definitely or probably will show up to vote in the November 2022 elections. And this surpasses what we typically see this time of year. We heard loud and clear that racial discrimination, voting rights, and education are at the very top of their concerns. And perhaps, you know, the piece of data that sticks with me the most on this point is that over one third of Black women experience racism in their daily lives. Over one third experience racism in their daily lives. The third piece we found was that the economy is not back for all women, despite messages that we consistently hear out of the White House. While a majority of Black women now think that the country is heading in the right direction, it's not simply because of the economy. In fact, you know, over one third of Black women think that economic conditions are still getting worse. And we saw this to be the most stark among millennials and Gen Z. Over 41% named that the economy is getting worse to them. And, you know, frankly, that shouldn't surprise us when we see a lot of the economic impact data coming out of the last 18 months of the global health pandemic. The final piece I'll say is that we learned that living a successful life is not just about dollars in pocket. Wealth is not just about dollars in pocket. And that might sound weird to hear. When we asked further of Black women what that meant, they defined success as primarily being able to live ethical lives, to be able to live honestly, to have loving relationships with their friends and family, to not be dependent on anyone financially, to have a rewarding job, to have access to great schools and healthy foods.
Was anything that you heard surprising, or did you expect these responses?
That's a great question. You know, I think what we did expect to hear as a Black woman-led organization is that we define success, frankly, in an interdisciplinary way, and that it's going to take intersectional and intersectoral solutions to get there. And that's because oppression is inherently intersectoral and intersectional. I'd say the piece that, you know, continues to stick with me the most from the data is that women ranked voting rights and fighting racial discrimination as the top two items, the top two items that leaders across sectors need to be addressing. Not education, which did come next, not healthy foods, not the global health pandemic, but addressing the protection of voting rights and addressing racism and discrimination.
And I mean, I would assume also because addressing those things, everything else will trickle underneath it. But those are
exactly
some really important aspects to really tackle. You mentioned with success and happiness, you found that it's not about the dollar amount. It's about living a happy, healthy life and not being dependent on outside factors. Was that surprising at all?
To me, no. maybe as a focus of this data set. But I think it, you know, I think it can really give someone pause, right? Because one might be easily able to say that dollars in pocket will yield some of these outcomes or definitions that Black women further offered. And I think what this study is saying is that you do not need to be wealthy, or you do not, we should not create a society in which you must be wealthy. We do not need to create a society in which you must be wealthy to experience a successful life.
That's
amazing. That's what we heard in this data.
Yeah, that's really amazing. Just it's a different thing than what most folks, when they think about success, you know, we think about money and wealth and savings, and to say that that's not it, that's really cool.
Yeah, I agree. And I, you know, I think for me, I grew up in the education sector, and it makes me ask a question of what does it mean to create schools then that have this orientation? What does it mean to create a place where kids are showing up every day, being able to be in pursuit, perhaps, of this definition of living healthy and thriving lives? What does it mean if we're in the healthcare sector to create a system in which kids and their families are consistently able to access incredible foods, that they're able to access preventative care? How does that begin to shape this vision of a successful life? And I think when we start to ask those questions of wealth not being the thing driving us, but rather the ability to breathe, to simply live and to thrive, you know, where I'm optimistic is what type of system might that create for our kids and for future generations.
And I like the point you're making about, you know, just even in the education realm, the focus is not on trying to get the most money. I think sometimes we get led down that path, like what job can we get the most money out of versus what is maybe more satisfying to us.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. You know, and just to bring it back to the study, we found that Black women want to have rewarding jobs, and they want that to live alongside living honestly and having deep and loving relationships with their friends and family. And so to your point, it is more than just the sheer economics that we might have a reflex to always go back to.
Were you able to find in this study some of the hurdles faced by Black women when it comes to getting to their level or definition of success?
Sure. I mean, number one right now that's top of mind for women is the protection of voting rights. And I think to your point from a few minutes ago, your ability to be seen in a democratic system and to access that democratic system with equity and justice at the core, if that is in direct jeopardy to Black women right now, which it is, it's in jeopardy for more than Black women, then there's a strong correlation to my mind with the policy solutions that come with it, or the policy solutions that may not further center them if voting rights is further jeopardized by policymakers. So that definitely, you know, I just continue to ring that loud and clear. You know, I think on fighting racial discrimination, we heard that was at root as the barrier to wealth, whether you define that as dollars in pocket or more holistic example or definition that we heard very clearly in the research. Black women see racial discrimination as the key to economic success. And we heard that they believe that people who are wealthy, it's more so the result of advantages rather than hard work. Mm. We heard that Black women are most worried long-term about their kids and retirement. And yet again, we saw racism and discrimination come up very quickly as we asked about long-term perspective. And then I'd say the final piece is, you know, we continue to see throughout this study just tremendous economic angst from single Black women in particular. And knowing the research that exists far outside of this, it unfortunately isn't surprising. You know, Black women under the age of 35, their medium wealth fell to $101 since the global health pandemic. And that's in contrast to white men under the age of 35, whose medium wealth is over $22,000. And so it's no surprise that we saw this in the data set. And I think we at the Highland Project want to continue to shine a light on this data, but we're also ready for policymakers to really dig into moving from rhetoric to action to address this data.
Well, Gabrielle, we have about a minute left. What are you planning to do? What are the next steps now with this data that you've collected?
Sure. So we'll actually be in Indianapolis next week, partnering with the Mind Trust to discuss this data and what it means for community members in Indianapolis. And you'll continue to see us do this across the nation over the coming weeks and months. We think it is incredibly important that when we're focused on equity, that we actually start with listening to Black women about what they need and want. The second piece that's most exciting for us right now is we are in the thick of recruitment and selection for the first cohort of Black women leaders who we will support. And I'm looking forward to the day at the end of November where we're announcing women across the country who we're investing in their leadership, we're investing in their brilliance, and we're providing over $1.5 million in unrestricted capital to really scale their visions for success.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us, Gabrielle. It's been a pleasure, and we hope to touch base again in the future. Gabrielle Wyatt is the founder of the Highland Project. After a quick break, we'll talk to more guests about how people define success and how to work towards personal goals. If you have any questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana, or leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. The way success is defined is different for everyone. For some, it might mean having a job that makes them feel like they're making a difference. For others, it could mean being a good parent and having a family. Regardless of how you measure success, it's important to identify what it means to you. We're joined now by two guests. Joe Holt is a James E. Jack teaching professor of business ethics at the Mendoza College of Business at the University of Notre Dame. And Nate Cornell is a professor of psychology at Williams College in Massachusetts. Thank you to both of you for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Joe, I'll start with you. How do you personally define success?
I'm a person of faith. The question I ask myself is, you know, whenever I'm deciding what job I should do, what relationships I should be in, how should I channel my time and energy, all of that. My question is, you know, where am I most alive in God and for others? Where am I doing the most good in life? Where am I most energized in life, so that as I near the end of my life, I have maximum cause for rejoicing, minimum cause for regret.
So it sounds like it's more of a higher purpose of living.
Yeah, and I think, you know, and whether somebody's a person of religious faith or not, everybody can find a higher purpose, just, you know, devoting your limited time, talent, and energy to something you really care about and believe in.
Nate, what about you? How do you define success?
I struggle with this because when I was younger, I didn't think about it. And success was about, like, you just try to win whatever competition you're in. And, you know, I'm a competitive person. And so one of the things I've learned about myself is that I have to try to, I define success for myself partly by deciding what contests I'm going to participate in. So, like, if I don't, for example, if I feel like I don't want to write a book because I maybe I could, but I don't want to go on a public speaking tour because it makes me anxious. well, then I'm just not going to allow myself to think of book writing as a competitive thing that I try to win. And by letting myself kind of set goals that I think are important for me on a practical level, that's how I'm able to kind of achieve things without also freaking myself out all the time. And that's kind of like success for me, I guess.
Yeah, kind of staying in a comfort zone and not maybe feeling compelled to do more because everybody else is doing more.
Right, and still trying to do more. That's a lot of times people ask me about success and they say, well, if I change my goals, then doesn't that just mean I'm giving up and I'm not going to end up achieving anything? And the thing is, no, you can still have, you know, you should still set high expectations for yourself in important ways. It's just that you can choose, you can try to choose, you know, what those are. And as Joseph said, it's like sometimes you have to think 30, whatever your age is, when you're getting towards the end of that, you know, your work career or your family life or whatever, your whole life, you say, well, where do I want to be then? And sometimes that kind of long-term perspective changes your goals as well. You know, you say, I don't want to be the person who doesn't take weekends off ever because I'm too busy. I have to change my schedule so that I'm not too busy anymore.
Right, right. Yeah. Miriam, Nate said something very interesting that, you know, early on he didn't think much about it. In the opening intro, you mentioned that, you know, everybody has their own definition of success. I take it you're an optimist?
Actually, okay. I'll give credit to the producer for writing that. I'm in between. I would say I used to be a very glass half full type of person or half empty. Yeah. But yeah, I'm a mix.
But it's interesting. I used to give a talk on measuring success in life to a group of incoming MBA students, and about 150 of them. I started off by saying, how many of you plan to be successful? All the hands go up. How many of you plan to work hard to achieve success? All the hands go up. How many thought long and hard about what which MBA program would most help you achieve success? All the hands go up. How many can honestly say you thought equally long and hard about what constitutes success in the first place? Far fewer hands went up. So I think there are a lot of people who are working hard to be successful who haven't thought long and hard about what constitutes success, just kind of accepting society's definition of success.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. I'm just thinking from my own perspective of success that when I was younger, I would say like, yeah, it's achieving things, tangible things or recognition. Yeah. And then the older you get, you're like, no, I want something that makes me feel good about myself and that I'm doing something beneficial in the world. Like, I don't care about awards anymore.
Yeah.
And you know, there's research on this. There's quite a bit of research on this in the psychology world, which is where I'm from. And having a feeling that you are making a meaningful contribution at work or even at home, you know, this is an incredibly important thing. And if you get a job, you know, like for example, my wife used to have a job where she was paid well and stuff and she had nothing to do. She hated it. She was so miserable because she didn't feel like she was actually accomplished anything. And she wanted to feel good at something. See, there's another deep psychological need that I think everybody just has. It's built into us that we want to feel competent. We want to feel like what we do matters, but also that we're good at it. And you can't get around that. So I think especially during COVID, this was one of the biggest problems I saw from a psychological standpoint was that people were stuck in situations where they didn't feel like they could do anything. And that helplessness and you know, and you're just not getting compliments. You're not seeing people. You're not, even work was like, my work was kind of slowed down. And I know my kids were in school and I was seeing on them on Zoom and it was like, it was kind of a, I think the teachers were doing their best, but it was a nightmare. And nobody was like feeling like that sense that I'm making a contribution and I'm good at anything. And that kills you. That's so hard to take.
Yeah. I totally agree with both of those, you know, the competence and the purpose. The purpose part of it is making me think of Gabrielle's earlier comment that, you know, for the women she works with, it's not just about dollars, but they have to loving relationships, but also feel they're living ethically, living an honest life. So to me, the purpose has got to be reflective of the values and beliefs that define you. Because, you know, if you're living in such a way that what you're doing is not consistent with those values and beliefs, it's hard to consider your life successful as a whole.
Yeah, that seems to be kind of a hard balance sometimes, because if you enter certain fields or things that you anticipated would be one way and it's the other, and you're like, what am I getting myself into?
Yeah. Students once asked me, how do you choose the right major? And I said, well, ask yourself if you'd ever read a book in that subject area if it weren't required.
Oh, that's a good one.
Because if the answer is no, then you're studying something you're not really into. And having done that for 4 years, you're probably going to get a job you're also not really into. You know, and it's hard to be super happy when you're devoting most of your waking hours to something your heart's not really into. Go ahead, Nate, please.
And I just wanted to add, this sort of brings up another one of these key needs. You know, there's a psychological idea, this thing called Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which is kind of like, research-wise, it's a little bit old school, but it's really fascinating. And another one of these needs is this feeling of authenticity. And, you know, in fact, Gabrielle talked about the idea that people in her surveys want, one of the things they wanted to do is be honest. And that's about being authentic to yourself is the same. It's similar to being honest. And I think in terms of choosing majors, you know, I've had so many students who have told me, I don't really know what I want to major in, but I know what I'm going to major in because my parents want me to major in it. You know, it's incredibly common, you know, and often it's usually, you know, we don't have things like pre-law because it's a liberal arts college, but we have like, you know, economics is a big one of those. And so what happens is the student ends up, not being authentic to themselves in a way that can be kind of damaging and that they can regret later on. Because later on you find out, wait, this is my life and I don't actually want to do this, but now I'm stuck. Yeah. But there's other kinds of authenticity that I think people get squashed. You know, as a radio host, you're not allowed to just say whatever you want. As a professor, I'm not going to just start cursing right now, but that might be my authentic self. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so like everybody should go out there and get piercings and dye their hair and like, you know, be yourself instead of trying to impress other people all the time.
Yeah.
Flourish as the unique individual you are.
Yeah.
I think that's something that I don't know if it's just human nature that we're always chasing, we're trying to get there. And I feel like there's just so many constraints just on that society places on us. So even if you're trying to be authentic, it's hard. You really have to push through.
You know, on the authenticity, there's an interesting little book written by a woman who is a hospice nurse, Bronnie Ware. She wrote this book, The Top Five Regrets of the Dying, just based on the experience of spending time with people on the doorstep of eternity, people who are soon going to die. And I used to do volunteer work as a nurse's aide with terminal cancer patients, so it resonates with me. But the top regret of the dying was, I wish I'd had the courage to live a life true to myself, not the life others expected of me. It's all about authenticity.
It's incredibly deep. It's surprisingly hard to do, you know, like you think, well, of course I'm just going to be myself, but then you find yourself kind of painted into corners sometimes. And, you know, I think some of these things are really, really deep and others are much more surface things, but I bet everybody's had that experience where you're, you know, like if I go look at old pictures from when I was in my 20s or something like that, and then I turn around and look at my living room of my house now, I'm like, I almost feel like a different person. Sometimes I wonder, like, is that shift more towards authenticity, or was that old self? Sometimes that old self feels more like me because he was kind of dumber and more just kind of like going on instinct, you know?
It's the authentic aging you, like a fine wine.
I wish.
Well, I mean, I'd like further on than you. So
I would say I'd like to think that when you look back and then you see that yes, you were authentic in that moment, and then now, let's say 10 years, 20 years later, there's so much growth. So I wouldn't say that. I mean, I don't know. I'm not an expert. That's just my thoughts.
Well, can I go back to also again mentioning the previous interview with Gabrielle? I think one of the things that racial discrimination does to people is it prevents you from being authentic in some ways if you kind of have to conform to, you know, a set of rules that isn't, you know, they're sort of like, you know, you hear, I've definitely heard people talk about how they speak in one voice when they're with white people and another voice when they're with black people, if they're black, when they're talking to their family or something like that. And this is a shift that I, as a white man, don't have to make. But it's taking you away from your authentic self in a sense. And so this is just one of the many ways in which racial discrimination takes away from people. And it takes away in a way that's not measurable. You can't see that in a paycheck or anything, but it takes away all the same at a psychological level that's really deep.
Yeah, I agree with that. And in terms of pressure, Harvard did an interesting study a few years ago, and they found that if black and Asian students whiten their resumes. So take out that you belong to the Black Student Association and you got this or that scholarship, have a more white sounding name. They were like 30% more likely to get interviews and callbacks. So there's pressure to, you know, if you are not authentic to who you really are, you know, the world is going to work better for you in certain ways, which is really, really unfortunate and something we need to keep working on.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, from my own experiences as an Arab American Muslim woman, it's definitely difficult when you're in society and you feel like you have to fit into a certain thing, take things off your resume, stuff like that. And then you never feel like you're really authentic. It's like, I'm always like, if people really knew how I am or my personality, like, I wish I could let them know the real me sometimes.
But
the older I get, the more comfortable I am in my own skin. But I would say, like, younger years, it was really hard.
Yeah. And I do a course on gender equity, and it's interesting, relevant to that, Gabrielle. Women are often pressured to live up to a masculine model of leadership. But then when they do that, they're criticized for not being feminine enough. So it's kind of like there's this pressure on you in different ways to, like, not be who you really are, flourish as that person.
Well, I do want to go back and ask, is there anything that would be like a universal definition of success? Is there something that everybody could, I guess, grab onto that definition for themselves?
Well, you know, there are really basic needs. Like, we all need to feel safe, and we all need to have enough nutrition. You know, these are almost like physical needs. But I think if you look at how humans evolve, we need to be in social groups. There's so much research about this. And how damaging it can be to be isolated. I mean, this has been demonstrated. Harry Harlow did these experiments with monkeys back in the 50s and 60s, you might have heard about. But also, if you look at things like being in isolation when you're a war prisoner, for example, it's like completely devastating. So this is another like basic need. I think one of the things that drives people a lot is competitiveness, which can go both ways. You know, I think when you know, my son was in math class last year, not last year, the year before, because last year they were on Zoom, but the year before, it was like math was just a contest. That's all it was. The teacher would ask a question, who could answer it fastest? Or if not fastest, who could answer it loudest? You know, and humans are like that. And so, again, it goes back to this idea that we don't all agree about what it is we're trying to succeed at, but if whatever your goals happen to be and whatever rules you get, whatever game you're playing in life, you're trying, most people are trying to win it. And that's not always healthy, but I think that's pretty true.
I agree on the close relationships. I mean, as Nate was saying, the studies consistently show like number one driver of true happiness is close relationships. So, you know, taking time to develop great relationships, but then just as importantly, giving those relationships the time they deserve. So, sometimes we try so hard to be successful in our careers that we don't give our relationships the time they deserve to kind of be well. In terms of definition of success, Miriam, I think the number one thing it'd be helpful for people to do is not buy into the prevailing societal definition, because the Oxford American Dictionary definition is the attainment of wealth, fame, or position. But I'm sure you can think of people who've got wealth, fame, or a high position who you would not consider successful in life as a whole. Because it says nothing about the kind of person you are. It says nothing about the kind of relationships you have. It says nothing about the impact you have on the lives of other people. And surely all of that matters to being successful or not. But I think, you know, flourishing as a unique individual you are, or if you're a person of faith like me, flourishing as a unique individual God has made you to be, I think that's pretty universal in terms of successful. You know, living your own dream instead of the dream other people have for you.
Yeah, that's something that I think about often is how to live your life without living it the way you maybe assume other people are expecting you to live it. And I just wonder where that came from, this idea that to be successful, you have to appease this anonymous crowd out there. And we have about a minute left. So before we go to break, we can come back and talk about this. But I will say, Nate, is there a difference between being fulfilled and feeling successful?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can feel there are plenty of people who feel like I'm successful in all the ways that society defines success as, and I'm also miserable. And I mean, I've been that person before, you know, like I'm not I'm not like rich and famous, but you know, I have a good job and I have a great family. And if you look at me from the outside, I look successful, and then I'm like not happy sometimes. And that's just reality.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Joe?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, what percentage of people that you know would you say are truly fulfilled in what they do for work? How many of them look forward to Mondays?
Not a lot.
Right. So no matter how much money you're making, I mean, you do need a certain amount of money just to be able to take care. You know, Nate was saying, you know, the hierarchy of needs and everything like that. But, you know, how much is enough, and what's the trade-off between meaning and money? I gave a talk once on the money, meaning, and the avoidance of misery. And the point was, unless you find some meaning in the work you're doing, you will be more or less miserable.
Right. Well, we'll be back after a quick break. We're talking about how to define success. I'm Miriam. So back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam. So back now to our discussion on success. So far, we've talked about what success really means and how answering that question impacts our lives and the choices we make and the difference between success and fulfillment. Now we're going to delve into social media and American culture and how that plays a role in the way we view success. With us again are Joe Holt, a James E. Jack teaching professor of business ethics at the Mendoza College of Business at the University of Notre Dame, and Nate Cornell, a professor of psychology at Williams College in Massachusetts. So before the break, I kind of touched upon this idea that living our lives for the anonymous crowd out there is something that a lot of people struggle with. Is this a result of social media, or have we always had this tendency to look for validation from outsiders?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's both. I think there's this concept of the what they call the hedonic treadmill, where no matter how good things get, it's kind of like you're running in place and you just get used to whatever you have and then you just want more. You know, so you could, I mean, there's this great quote in this book by Michael Lewis. I forget which one, but it's basically this guy who's making $1 million a year. And he's like, there's no way I could survive on $800,000 a year at this point. And I'm sitting there like, what? Like, are you on earth? So, but the thing is, that's actually, it's laughable and you want to make fun of him, but that's the reality of human existence, is that it's hard not to want more all the time. Yeah. And so that's what we end up doing. And, you know, if you can find a way to like be satisfied with what you have, that's when you can't get to the goal if your goal is to always be better. That's mm-hmm. not a goal you can achieve. Only maybe Michael Jordan achieved it in the NBA, but that's about it. You can achieve feeling satisfied with your life if you say to yourself, okay, look how well you're doing. That's, you've reached the goal. Now stop changing the goal. Don't move the goalposts. Let's be happy with what we got. You know, and you don't want to do that and then stop putting effort into your work or into your family life or the other things you care about. Because if you stop doing that, then you're not going to feel competent anymore. But you can also have both, I think.
So I agree with all of that on hedonic adaptation. I think the other powerful force that goes on is social comparison. We kind of judge ourselves as doing well or not, not by looking at what we have, but by looking at what we have in comparison with what some other relevant group has. So, you know, I was a corporate attorney and we got a raise, almost doubled our salary within 2 years, but we didn't consider ourselves in comparison with the average salary in America. We did in comparison with how much the partners were making, and then we were miserable. So the Dalai Lama said we have the comparing mind. We don't look at what we have and give thanks. We look at what we don't have and regret it. But on social comparison, H.L. Mencken back in early 20th century defined success as making $100 a year more than your wife's sister's husband.
which is true.
Right. It's social comparison. On the adaptation piece, too, it's interesting. The economist at USC, Richard Easterlin, wrote this really interesting essay explaining happiness. And he said there are different dimensions of well-being, monetary and non-monetary. So non-monetary is, you know, your health, close relationships, meaning work, et cetera. And he said within each dimension, we have on the one hand a level of aspiration where we want to be, on the other hand, level of attainment where we are. And he posited that happiness increases when you narrow the gap between aspiration and attainment. But he said the interplay of those two is different in the non-monetary dimensions, because in monetary dimension, you know, if you get a raise, so your level of attainment goes up, does your level of aspiration stay the same? And I think the indications are no, it goes up at the same time and to about the same extent. So you never really narrow the gap. It's just like you can go further down your wish list of stuff you'd like to buy because you got more money. But when it comes to, you know, non-monetary dimensions, like, you know, finding a great friendship, when you find, you think about your best friend. When you find that friend, do you find yourself wondering, well, you know, someone, she's really amazing, but I wonder if I could find an even better best friend? No, you just kind of give thanks. So when it comes to those dimensions, we really do experience an increase in happiness and well-being when we narrow the gap. But his point is that Americans in general spend too much time on the monetary dimension and end up unsatisfied and ought to be devoting more time and energy to the non-monetary dimensions, like your physical health, close relationships, meaningful work, all of that.
And I would say that the pandemic kind of exacerbated that, didn't it? Didn't it open people's eyes to that?
I think so. Absolutely. Yeah, life shaking. Go ahead, Nate.
Oh, going back to your comment about your initial question, I think one of the things the pandemic did was, for me personally, but I know this is a larger pattern as well. When I would go on Facebook or something like that and somebody was happy, I was like, ugh, barf. You know, I did not want to see that at all. I was like, I hope, because the thing is, I was not happy, you know, and I know that people in my family weren't happy. And so what you see, I mean, we all know this, what you see on Facebook is like, you take the 1 minute out of every 10 days that's the best part of your life, and you put that on Facebook or on Instagram or Snapchat or TikTok, whatever. And so we get this really false impression of what's going on with our friends. And so this social comparison thing becomes more toxic because instead of me comparing myself to my neighbor or my best friend and knowing what they're actually up to, I'm comparing myself to some idealized version. And I think with COVID, people kept doing that idealized version online,
right?
But in reality, you know, it was completely different. And so, I know that the college students that I'm interacting with here at Williams, and I don't think it's limited to college students, but they, are having a huge problem with this because nobody shares their darkest feelings and thoughts with the general population. And which is why actually as a good deed to society, I'm being totally sincere, I have actually been bringing people down by telling them, hey, I'm not doing that great. You know, like I'm having a rough week and stuff like that, just to kind of like balance the universe in terms of what is being put out there about mm-hmm. how other people are doing.
So when people ask how you're doing, you answer honestly?
That's great. Not when I'm passing them in the hall, but if they were sitting in chairs, then I do.
Okay. So I agree with all of that. It seems like, you know, social comparison has always been around, but with social media, it's like social comparison on steroids. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's interesting that in ethics now, the focus is on the question, what should I do? But at the beginning of ethics, the focus was on a wiser question, which is how should I live? And our answers to that, I think, you know, as you said, Miriam, everybody, you know, has their own definition or should have their own definition. But I think our answer to that question is driven by our sense of what most matters in life. And I think what the pandemic has done is cause a lot of people to rethink what does most matter in life, what is most important, and all of that. I had the experience of volunteering as a nurse's aide in an ICU when Chicago was a hot zone, working with only COVID patients. And saw a lot of that up close and personal. I took 13 bodies to the morgue myself. Saw a lot of death and a lot of really horrible suffering. And that changes what you think matters in life. And being alive matters. And being able to, I didn't have a single patient who could get out of bed, who could eat, who could speak. So what I found is, on the one hand, it breaks your heart to see people suffering so much. On the other hand, it leads you to take extraordinary delight in ordinary pleasures. The fact that you can get out of bed, you can go out for a walk in the sunshine, you can go for a run, you can speak, you have a future you can think of, you know, all of that kind mm-hmm. of, you're not in pain, all of those kinds of things that I think a lot of us just take for granted.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it reminds me of a saying that I've heard often where, you know, whenever you're feeling down or not so great about your life, visit the hospitals, visit sick people.
Yeah.
And I think there's a second reason that's valuable. In addition to the fact that it gives you perspective, it's also, when I ask students, because I teach classes about the psychology of success, and I ask students to write down, like, what are some of your goals or what are some of your successes in the past? And they're virtually 100% about myself. Mm-hmm. Like, what have I done? Which makes total sense, and I have no criticism. However, what that doesn't take into account is that for most people, actually, one of the best feelings is when you help someone else, and you do it in a meaningful way, and you can tell that it made a difference. They don't have to thank you, but you can tell it made a difference. That is, if you really reflect on it, that's an amazing feeling. But it's not like nobody buys tickets for that. You go see the basketball game or you go to the movies, yeah.
Right.
But helping people is free, you know. And in fact, even just giving compliments is free. And you know, these are things that if you start to do them, you know, it might be a little bit inauthentic at first, but it can become real. And those are the kind of goals that I think you look back on and you say, like, okay, I needed to find something in my life that would be more meaningful for me. So what I did is I went and helped people with something, and I can be proud of that no matter what.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's like the kind of advice that when I give this to college students, they're too busy. Like, they got other problems, so they can't really do it. But once you're feeling like a little bit more established in your life, maybe that's something you can do, as you, Joseph, obviously did by volunteering.
Yeah. Absolutely. You know, it's interesting. John Stuart Mill and others have raised this question, like, you know, who are the happiest people? And if you think about the absolute happiest people you know in life, and I don't mean tra-la-la happy. I mean, you know, joyful and at peace kind of people. Are they the people who are most focused on their own happiness? And in my experience, no. The people I know who are most focused on themselves are the most miserable people. I know. Yeah. The people I know who are happiest are in great relationships. And to Nate's point, I mean, they care about others. And they experience happiness as a byproduct of caring for others, not as what they are aiming at. You know, the other interesting thing on this me focus is I was teaching a seminar once, and about 25 students, and about 10 of them were married, and about 6 of them were parents. And I said, I'm going to throw out a word, and I want you to write down the three things that first come to mind. And the word I threw out was success. And they wrote things down, they handed them in. And what's interesting is not a single person who was married included being a good spouse. Not a single person who was a parent included being a good parent. Everything they wrote down had to do with career success. And there are people who love their spouses and love their children, but it's just when they think success, that's not what they think.
Wow. And, you know, I'm just thinking about that as is it a societal thing because we place so much emphasis on people's status and career and title?
Yeah. Well, think about in 2012 when Mitt Romney was running for president and he's criticized for being super wealthy and out of touch. And he said, I'm not going to apologize for being successful. What did he mean by that? He didn't mean that he has a great marriage and a great family. He meant that he made a lot of money. Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's just too narrow a definition, I think.
Yeah, and I think also going back to the idea of competence that we were talking about earlier and how important that is for psychological feelings of success, people don't feel like being a good, in my case, father, is a sign of competence, but it is. And I think that could actually, you know, as there are not very many things in life that where it's like happiness comes for free. That's really, really more optimistic than I want to be because I'm not really an optimist. But focusing your life a little bit more on like, hey, I did a good job talking to my daughter today. So that should give me a feeling of competence or, you know, those kind of feelings of competence can really be valuable and you earn them, you deserve them. But sometimes people don't sort of like take those rewards.
Yeah, I'm definitely taking notes here and be like, okay, the kids had breakfast and they made it to school this morning. I'm good.
Yeah. Yeah. I only cried twice.
There's an old Billy Joel song, Angry Young Man, and one of the lines is, I found that just surviving is a noble fight. I mean, during the pandemic, that's true.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's a success, getting through the day. We're all alive. We're healthy.
Yeah. Well, have views on success in America changed at all, do you think? Or is it still sort of this one view in our culture, Joe?
You know, I've been teaching for a long time, like since the 80s, and I love the millennials. The millennials get slammed a lot, but I say God bless the millennials. They give me more hope than I've ever had in my life that things can be really, really different in terms of true happiness and work-life balance and gender equity and racial justice and all of that. I think there's a lot of stuff that people have put up with for years that they just won't put up with. And they want meaning in work, and they want to work for companies that are making a positive difference, and they want to find something they can put their heart into. I find a lot of wisdom in them. So I think with them, it really is changing in ways that, in my opinion, are more wise.
Nate, are Americans too focused on career success if we look at it from sort of a cultural perspective?
Yes, I think so. I mean, you know, and this is tricky because, you know, the United States has a huge GDP and we're a nation that's very powerful in the world, obviously. And, you know, at the same time, I'm like, let's all work less hours. Like, let's all go home early on Fridays, you know. And as a professor, you can kind of just goof around all the time. But I think a lot of people really have to work. And so decreasing the amount of work people do, I think would be healthy. I think if you work too little, you don't feel the competence, and that's not good for you. But, you know, life is about priorities, especially when it comes to things like success. And if you want to ask the question, are we too focused on work in terms of what success is? Part of it comes down to what are we prioritizing in terms of our time? And also, here's the other thing. If you look at the United States compared to other countries with respect to levels of clinical measures of happiness, such as like levels of depression and anxiety, which are correlated with happiness. It's not the same thing. They're actually kind of high in the United States. And there's a really weird paradoxical thing that tends to be true even when things get worse in this country. Like after 9/11, rates of suicide, depression, and anxiety actually leveled out or went down, because there was such a feeling of common cause and unity. And sometimes bad things that I absolutely 100% do not want to happen again, but they do have this paradoxical benefit. And there's something about modern society in the United States and other parts of the world that is also hurting us.
Well, we are about to wrap up. We have about a minute left. Joe, did you have anything you wanted to add on that point?
No, I had a friend whose father was a partner at a big accounting firm, and he had a rich and full life, very involved in his community and very involved in volunteering and running and traveling. And he once said, you know, there are partners who make more money than I do, and there are partners who have a bigger office than I do. And there are days when I envy them their bigger paycheck and bigger office, but I wouldn't trade the total package I have in life for anybody else's total package. So I think it's helpful to think about it in terms of your total package. There was a survey done a number of years ago asking people if they would accept 20% less pay to be able to spend 20% more time with their loved ones, and a lot of people said yes. So that's everybody got to find out what's the balance that works for you, but you know, get enough of everything you need.
Well, I want to thank you both for taking the time to join us this afternoon. I feel like there's so much more we can talk about, so hopefully we can chat again. Joe Holt is a James E. Jack Teaching Professor of Business Ethics at the Mendoza College of Business at the University of Notre Dame. And Nate Cornell is a professor of psychology at Williams College in Massachusetts. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.